Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Kia ora, Stefano. Welcome, everyone, to the New Books Network. I'm your new host, Adam On, to the New Books in Australia and New Zealand Studies. This is my first time doing this, so please bear with me. I'm doing a fantastic book today. It is written by Jared Davidson. The book's name is The History of a Riot, and it is a microhistory of a specific event in Nelson. So, welcome, Jared.
Kia ora, Ed. Kia ora, Tato. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so I found the book really intriguing and very interesting because other books that we read in history are huge, several pages, but this just went into a specific time in New Zealand's history. So before we get into that, how did you get interested in this subject? And if you can enlighten us with some of your background as well.
Sure. This book actually came out of an in-between time. So I was in between books. I'm a labour historian and an archivist, and I just finished writing Dead Letters, Censorship and Subversion in New Zealand with Otago University Press. And I'd looked into the history of a riot in Nelson in 1843 briefly, and I thought, okay, why don't I dedicate a little bit of time to digging deeper into this particular history? So that was the genesis for the book. I'd seen it mentioned in various histories. Being an archivist working at Archives New Zealand, which is the government archive, there's a rich source of petitions and letters from Nelson, from the New Zealand Company in the 1840s. And so I decided, I'll dedicate talk about a year to focus on this particular event. So it drew on my background as a labour historian, interests in history from below, working class struggle, and also some of my previous books. I guess you'd call them biographies or collective social biographies of workers on the margins. And this event just seemed to tick all the right boxes.
So being an archivist, now I always imagine archivists. One of my friends was an archivist in Christchurch, and I always imagine someone with a monocle and just there's dusty files everywhere. How does that help you in writing these texts over the time?
Sure, that's a really common perception of archivists, and it probably surprises people when they rock up to the reading room to see a young guy with tattoos and black jeans and things like that. And it's partly the reality of what we hold. These are artifacts as stories and objects and items from the past, and in popular culture there is that kind of dusty librarian image of archivists, but actually it's a really thriving and interesting field to work in. The past archives of stories really impact on the present and on our future too. So being an archivist is a dream job for me, and having access to some really rich stories has really benefited my historical practice. To go back a little bit, I never trained as a historian. I actually have a background in graphic design and printmaking. And it wasn't until I was doing some printmaking for the Labour History Project for the centennial of the 1908 Blackball Strike that I started getting really interested in the anarchist movement and radicalism and working class unions in New Zealand. And I went to the archive to look into my first book, Remains to Be Seen, and I've been hooked ever since.
Yes, it seems to me a very interesting occupation, because for my master's recently, I've been delving into the website called Past Papers. And that's only a specific part of history, but it is intriguing, and it's like a YouTube rabbit hole that you go in from one new story to another new stories to different newspapers within the past paper in a specific period of time. So I completely understand. It must be a fascinating and exciting line of work. So the story of Nelson. Now, just to set up the stage, in 1843, what was Nelson like?
Sure. So the Te Reti o Waitangi had been signed in 1840, and it was a race against time in terms of the colonial authorities in the UK with this colonizing company called the New Zealand Company, who had actually sent a boatload of settlers out to Wellington as the treaty was being signed. And Nelson was a part of the New Zealand Company's other settlements. There was another one in New Plymouth as well. So in Nelson in 1843, the scene is a small port town that's steadily filling up with immigrants who have left England mostly, some from Wales and Ireland and Scotland as well. And they're arriving by the boatload. We're talking thousands of people here. And the idea is that these working class immigrants would find work, be employed by capitalists, and the sufficient price of land, what Edward Wakefield called the sufficient price, would kind of replicate an English class system, but not to the extent that working class people couldn't break out of being workers. You know, eventually they'd be able to buy land and become proper settlers. The problem was that a lot of the capitalists never came out. They were absentee landowners. They preferred to sit on the landed capital of land back in England. And so you had all these workers arriving in Nelson to very little work. One of the reasons why Nelson was so popular as a place to settle was that the company had guaranteed employment in its handbills across Great Britain advertising this scheme. And so when all these workers were arriving, finding themselves without work, with little food and supplies, with a land that was not a land of milk and honey, it was barren and pretty unfertile, the workers were put on relief schemes. They're basically employed to build roads, dig ditches, and earn their rations via the company. And that's where the problem started, because the company, as a capitalist venture, wanted to reduce those rations, and these workers wanted to survive, and that's what's led into the revolt.
So the promises that were made in the advertising of the heaven of New Zealand, what specific promises that you found through your research? Were there pamphlets? Were they showing them that the life would be fantastic, like we see real estate ads? Was it something like that?
Yeah, there was a little bit of that. There were handbills and advertisements and newspapers and stuff. But the company actually had a pool of agents, and these agents would go out into villages and parishes and often draw on their personal links within the community to sell New Zealand. And so those agents were kind of given a mandate, I guess, to talk up the scheme. And some of those agents maybe went a bit beyond what the company had ideally promised. And in some cases, you see, as soon as things start to go south in Nelson, the company's writing back to the agents to say, right, you've got to stop promising this. It's not working out this way. So, yeah, it was a mix of published pamphlets, and we're talking in an era of publishing as well, but also those personal community links. And that's one of the things I wanted to do with this book, was to trace these working class people back to where they'd come from and look at that a little bit deeper as well.
Yeah, there are fantastic stories within the book. When you delve into, you start getting the idea of what life they were leading and what were their dreams and hopes when they landed in New Zealand. So before coming here, who was a person ideal to come to New Zealand on this boat? Who were the type of people who decided, okay, I'm going to uproot my life and go to New Zealand?
Sure. I think there's this perception of Nelson and New Zealand in particular of pioneering kind of men and women made good. You know, everyone comes here from a hard life. They become pioneering farmers and everything's great ever after. A lot of those stories did work out that way. For sure, but it wasn't always the case. So the people that the company in particular were recruiting, they were looking for agricultural laborers in the first instance. So they were recruiting people who worked in the fields, but there was also a mix of what we call mechanics or artisans as well, people who had kind of worked in the industrial mills, the looms, things like that. So you had a mix of agricultural laborers and more kind of industrial orientated workers. And a lot of them were leaving behind the workhouse. You know, Francis Blinko in particular was one settler who, working class immigrant, sorry, who came to Nelson. He almost missed his sailing because he had robbed the workhouse. He was due to be transported to Australia and ended up coming to New Zealand instead. And there were some screening that the company did. Those agents would screen and find out the occupation, where they were from, and things like that. And luckily, because of that screening, we have these great registers held in the National Library, the Alexander Turnbull Library, that documents some of their backgrounds. But yeah, certainly a lot of them were leaving behind quite grimy industrial and hard agricultural labor, to start a new life across quite unforgiving oceans and what was to them quite a new land.
It's very interesting, that part of it. The idea behind having these two classes, or maybe several classes, we can delve into that a little bit later. But when New Zealand Company came, what were the main reasons behind New Zealand Company's idea of, okay, we're not just going to be bringing in settlers who will be settling on land and then doing their own thing? What prompted Edward Gibbon to decide that, okay, we need a labor class, we need someone to come in and work the land and do other menial jobs? Was it a thing of that the settlers didn't want to do that job, or, as you mentioned, well, most of the settlers were absent settlees, I guess you can say that. But what kind of prompted this new type of capitalism that he was going for?
Oh, that's a really good and complex question that a lot of historians in New Zealand have been grappling with for a long time. You know, on one side of this coin, you've got Edward Gibbon Wakefield as this kind of ruthless venture capitalist who's scheming these colonization plans from Newgate Prison. Marx famously in Capital kind of dismisses Wakefield and his scheme as as kind of just another venture capitalist kind of scheme. And then on the flip side, you have others writing about Wakefield having witnessed other colonization schemes in Canada, the USA, and Australia, and wanted to do it differently, and in particular had a humanitarian bent, which is why he wanted to be able to bring out labourers who would become landowner gentry eventually. The jury's still out on that one, and you could have a whole podcast about it, but essentially Wakefield saw an opportunity to do something different and made it happen in New Zealand. The thing was in Nelson that, some of those so-called old world scenarios and settings ended up playing out in the so-called new world, and that's what I wanted to look at in this book.
Yes. So just focusing now within Nelson, how is a regular scene, a regular day looking like in the streets of Nelson? Who's working in the shops, and who's the fancy people with big hats walking around, and who are the how is it looking like the Wild West, or is it looking like a 18th century British city?
I would probably say a mix of both, and it's important to also footnote here that Tangata Whenua in Nelson had been in Nelson for a long time, and also iwi or tribes coming down from the south of the North Island into that area as well. So there was trading happening with Māori. You had schemes of a central township where small plots were starting to be developed, streets were being laid, wooden houses, pubs were springing up. But also part of the scheme was that you could buy a country plot. And part of the reason why Nelson started to look further afield into the Waido and things like that was because they were looking for flat land for these plots. So it's a mixture of kind of dusty streets, wooden and mud houses springing up. Of course, you're getting a jail and a lockup springing up. You've got a port that's in development with Māori trading sites. You've got ships coming and going from Wellington, where the kind of New Zealand company headquarters is based, and you've got the state starting to reach in as well, being based up around Auckland, but sending magistrates and things into Nelson. So it's a mix of kind of settlement starting to happen, but there's still an element of rawness, and part of the work that these men were put to was to dig these big drains and build these roads out of the township towards flat farmland, especially the Waimea Valley. And that's one of the key sites of the struggle or revolt, was those swampy grounds out in Waimea, and also the port as well.
Yes, so you mentioned it, you mentioned gangs, right? So just for our listeners, in this context, what does it mean by gangs of labourers in the Nelson context?
Sure. Gangs in this context was a group of workers, a collective gang that worked together, you know, on the road or on the land. They were basically a labour gang. So it was working together as a group. We have a connotation of word gangs in the modern sense was something completely different, but in the 19th century, labor gangs was a key part of settler colonialism, right from navvies and railway workers to farm hands to prison gangs, which is what I'm studying at the moment.
Yes, it's interesting because I came in from a place of ignorance in terms of the terms that were used in the book, and I had this image of gangs as we hear in the local zeitgeist of today. But as I read and understood, that's what it means. So it's a bit of a collective that is going.
Yeah. Now, you had, well, certainly on the New Zealand Company Works, you'd have gangs of about 15 to 20 people, sometimes larger, someone would be designated the lead gangman. He was often the person who would collect the pay. And it made sense because these workers had an experience of working the land in gangs back in Great Britain as well. They had experience of the commons, of walking the bounds, working collectively in harvest. So it was just a kind of natural development of how labor happened in the early 19th century, for men at least.
Yes, so you have come to the exact point of the question that I was about to ask. You mentioned that the struggle was gendered. Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, what I wanted to focus on was obviously this revolt of the gang men there. It was actually a sequence of events or riots that happened, and hopefully we can talk more about those. But the flip side of this work was that these men were family men. They'd come over to Nelson with their wives and children, and a lot of their livelihood and survival was premised on the unpaid labor, the gendered labor of their wives. And there's a term for this that other scholars have used. It's called making shift. And that's the work of women in the community making do with what they have to hand to basically support and reproduce labor power, in a sense. So although some of the record doesn't necessarily mention women in these marches or in these riots, there is one small extract where one of the workers talks about Amazonian women marching down to the company pay office and demanding with their menfolk the money that was owed to them. But behind the scenes, women are playing a really important part in this role to basically reproduce the menfolk to be able to get up and go do what they're doing.
Mm. So now we're at a point within Nelson. So, and what is the trigger point that leads to the revolt right at the start?
Well, a lot of these workers, we have to remember, it's a time where unions have only just been made legal. So right up until the 1830s, the idea of combination was persecuted. You couldn't join together as a collective or form a union. And one of the things that a lot of these people came to Nelson was bringing hopes for a different type of working environment. So pretty much from the get-go, workers are demanding 8 or 9 hour days, they're demanding an hour for lunch and various other working conditions. And some of the settlers complain about this. You know, they say it's really hard to find a laborer who will kind of work for more than 9 hours a day. As more and more workers start to arrive, that kind of balance of power shifts and the men are put on to relief work. And of course, the company is spending a whole lot of money. You know, it's a welfare scheme. They're paying these men and their families both money and rations to survive. And it's in their interests. The shareholders back in the UK are asking the company to basically reduce as much as possible the rations and pay that they're giving to these men. And so by January 1843, when there's a hint of a scheme of reduction, the gang men go on strike. And at this stage in 1843, there's about 390 men on these relief schemes. And so there's a strike in January. They march down to the port from their houses and work sites and demand an audience with Arthur Wakefield, who kind of promises them that they're getting paid well, they can survive, it's not as bad as other places, and if you just work hard, I'm sure you'll be able to become landowners soon enough. And that strike lasts for about 1 or 2 days. There's different accounts of whether that strike was peaceful or whether they were armed. And I was really interested in this. And they basically did prevent the reduction. Wakefield tries again to reduce the rations. He manages to do so. There's another revolt, a marching of the company office, this time in July 1843. And in between those two strikes, Arthur Wakefield has been killed in Wairau during the Wairau affray, where a number of settlers clashed with Ngāti Toa Rangatira over disputed land. And his replacement is a guy called Frederick Tuckett. And he doesn't have the same clout as Arthur Wakefield had with the workers. And when Tuckett tries to reduce the wages even further, the office is raided in July by armed gangmen. This is all kind of leading to a really volatile scene. The company's trying to reduce rations. The men are trying to survive and fight for what's due, what they believe is due to them, what was guaranteed to them. And in August, the company decides to appoint a timekeeper, someone who will go out to the gangs where they're working, make sure they're doing the proper work, and actually measure their performance in a way. And that's the kind of the straw that breaks the camel's back. These men...
Nobody likes micromanagement.
Yeah, exactly right. And you know, this is that era of what E.P. Thompson has written about in terms of the timekeeping and the power of time and the watch and industrial capitalism. All of this is kind of mingling into the swampy ground of Nelson. And it seems to me from the record and from what observers of the time wrote, that the gangs had basically decided to enough was enough. And once this timekeeper was going to come and visit them, they'd resist. And that's exactly what happened.
The story there in the marshes when they throw one of the time men and have a fight with them, that is quite intriguing, and I was quite absorbed in that story. So I would ask people to read the book to get into these specific scenes as well. Now, in terms of the specific people involved, we talk about George White, and you said that he was not a well-liked person. Can you elaborate on that a little bit? Within the settlers.
Yeah. So George White was the magistrate that was assigned by the fledgling state to be sent to Nelson. And he was sent to Nelson after the Wairau affray in June, where the other magistrate had been killed. So he's already replacing someone who has lost his life in a conflict with Māori. And George White does not kind of smooth the waters very well when he starts talking about the Wairau affray being justified, that the actions of Māori were justified, that the New Zealand company were a gang of 40 thieves. He's kind of played up as this radical, and the settlers basically refuse to acknowledge him when he arrives. Now, he's a really interesting guy because of his views and because of his understanding of the power of working class struggle. In a way, he's probably a little bit sympathetic to what's happening with the gangmen, but he finds himself facing this powerful and organized body of men and their wives who aren't taking no for an answer. And so when, you know, the central riot of the book happens on the 26th of August, he's kind of lined up. The timekeeper's been thrown in the ditch. He's been stoned. He doesn't know who the culprits are. He doesn't know the men well enough. So they decide that on payday, when the men march into town to receive their money, that George White, the magistrate, will jump out and capture the gangmen that had thrown the timekeeper into the ditch. So he's kind of stuck between a rock and a hard place. He's got to police work. He's got to police the law. But he's also disliked by some of the more well-to-do settlers in Nelson.
So he's essentially the sole representative of the government.
There are different representatives in terms of magistrates and custom officers and stuff. But yeah, okay. It's all kind of bundled into that, into George White's role.
So we've touched on the Tangata the Whenua and the Wairau affray in our conversation. There was a specific headline that you used in the book from the Nelson Examiner, which said there we are blessed with two privileged classes, Maoris and Roadmakers. So can you delve into a little bit of the attitudes of press towards Maoris and the labor class, plus what was the general attitude of Nelsonians towards Tanga the Whenua?
Yeah, sure. It's a really good question. And there's been some amazing research done for the Waitangi Tribunal and by the Mitchells in Nelson around Tangata Whenua in this area. The headlines were very interesting. So that comment came out of the fact that when the workers went down to the company office in the port in August and basically de-arrested their comrade from George White's grip using clubs and weapons. A week later, some of the ringleaders were arrested and hauled before the courts. And not only did the gangmen storm the courtroom, they forced the company and the magistrate to let them off, not only without a fine, but to pay them for the work that they hadn't done the week before. So there's this real sense of a power vacuum, or maybe better yet, that power is in the hands of the workers. George White is writing desperately to his authorities in Nelson for troops. He wants armed militia to be sent. He's trying to enroll special constables to kind of help him fight against the workers here. So that's where that quote of the privileged classes comes out. The second aspect was, after the Wairoa fray, the over-disputed land, there was a commission that looked into that dispute, and Fitzroy, the governor of the time, basically came down on the side of Māori and said that a fray happened because of settler greed for land, in a sense, and that they should have waited for the land dispute to be resolved by proper means. And so that didn't go well with some of the newspaper editorials and the settlers who were really keen to get onto the land and farm those bigger plots. So yeah, you have this mix of, I think, fear that the settlement could be overrun by Māori. They're on tenterhooks. There's rumours that Te Rauparaha is coming south from Kapiti to drive them all out. And so that's the context of this particular so-called riot as well. There's a lot of tension and fear happening. And one of the things I wanted to do with this book was to bring in the idea of emotion and not just look at things at a kind of high-level political structure, but also bring in the human element into the event as well.
Yes, and I definitely read that and felt that while reading the book, because you have gone into specific stories of people as well and how they felt and what was the mood of the nation in Nelson at that time. In terms of people who are were not involved within the riot in Nelson. I'm talking about just regular settlers who are working or just they're not involved in the labor movement, or they don't employ anyone. Did you find anything in the archives about what were they feeling? What was their mood towards the labor class?
Yeah, it's a bit mixed. So one diary that I made use of held at the Alexander Turnbull Library was a diary of a company surveyor. So he's not necessarily directly involved for the events that I depict, but he's capturing the sense of what's happening. And he's very disappointed that these events are happening. He kind of wants the company just to sort things out. But he's also sympathetic to the workers as well. And at one stage after the event, where there are rumours of an impending Ngāti Toa attack, the settlers get together and form a committee of safety, and they choose six of the gangmen to be involved. And there's arguments for and against this. Some are like, why would you put those same workers who are up in arms, literally, into a committee of defence? Their interests are not ours. But then the others are saying, well, actually, some of these guys have military backgrounds. They know the lay of the land. They know their way around Nelson. They'll be really useful in defending the settlement. So it's a real mix. And it's the same like any community when you start to drill down into it. Things aren't so stratified as we often think.
So coming to the actual event. Now, I didn't want to elaborate too much on the event because, you know, that's the main thesis and the main focus of the book as well. How much more you can share so that people are intrigued to go read a book? Because I was really excited about what actually happened on the day and then what it led to afterwards in terms of the changing of the company's practices.
Yeah, I think, you know, in my own personal experience of looking for histories of resistance, I've often looked overseas. It's not something I've always associated with New Zealand history. And to come across this event so early on in New Zealand's Pākehā history, at least, felt like a revelation to me. And I just really wanted to look at it. And at the time as well, I was reading a lot of English agricultural unrest kind of studies. So things about the swing riots of the 1830s and working the land and stuff. And I wanted to figure out, was there a connection between these 1830 riots and what was happening in Nelson? And that's part of the book. But essentially, as I mentioned earlier, briefly before, the men had thrown the timekeeper in the ditch. The timekeeper kind of said it was useless to go out and monitor these men. It wasn't safe to do so. Physical violence and property was unsafe. And the only way we could punish these guys was when they came in to get paid. So they formed up as a body, about 70 to 80 men of the three main gangs that were involved. And they marched down through the township out to Nelson Port, which is now Wakefield Quay, and confronted the company at the office. And as the timekeeper tried to pick out the men that had thrown him in the ditch, one of them is arrested by George White, the magistrate. And he kind of yells out, he says, "Come on, chums, they're taking me." And some of the gangmen charge into the office, clubs swinging, and essentially de-arrest their comrade. And the magistrates and the company kind of give up, and then the men form up and march off giving three cheers. It's just phenomenal. And so that was, you know, the background.
It's like a scene from a movie. I mean, and I feel like George White must be feeling very emasculated because he has no power in this scenario.
Yeah, and I mean him and others are writing that Nelson is in a state of anarchy. And you know that anarchy and anarchism in Nelson, 1840s, are you kidding? It's not the type of image that I'd certainly been brought up with or read about. So yeah, that was the focus, and I wanted to go back in time and think about why these men and their wives resorted to what they had done. What traditions of revolt and protest were they drawing upon? And I think that's the section of the book that I'm most proud of. It's really great to finally have a narrative of the events of what happened. And also, as you mentioned it before, of what happens afterwards, which is the complete recomposition of power in Nelson, both in terms of class, but also in terms of the landscape. So because of the protest, because of the revolt, the company decided to completely throw out its scheme of withholding land to the laboring classes. And so they decide to allocate 5-acre plots to the gangmen. Some of them take it up, some of them don't. But it essentially drives a wedge, a division into the body of workers, because now you have a group who have a landed interest in Nelson. And in a way, it diffuses the protests. And even that has a tradition of diffusing agricultural unrest back in Great Britain. And so, yeah, part two of the book really drills down to some of those backgrounds and histories of protest.
So you mentioned it is interesting that our regular histories have kind of ignored going deep into these events that might have happened in different cities. How important do you think, for Nelson's history, of course, that these micro histories are elaborated more within the context of the nation, of the treaty, of what was happening? Why would they be more important than the general history?
Well, I mean, I'm not sure if they're necessarily more important. I think they just add to that narrative and to the picture of colonial life. And you know, those general histories are really important. There's some amazing work by Jim McAloon of a regional history of Nelson. Ruth Allen kind of wrote the history of the early settlement, and they have a lot of ground to cover. And they do a good job at mentioning the struggle of these gang men. But by employing microhistory and diving deep into this particular event, but without neglecting the wider context, it gives historians a really fruitful field of research. Because I think, well, I was surprised by how much I could find, you know, and you mentioned Papers Past. I couldn't have done this work without things like Papers Past and, you know, the genealogical work of family historians who have created databases and used ancestry and kind of painted a picture of family history. So I'm really grateful to those family historians for doing that type of work. But it does show us that there are moments in New Zealand's history that are just ripe for deeper analysis. And I think this event in Nelson really does shine a light on settler colonialism, on labor, on divisions of class in a really kind of heady time, a tumultuous time of settlement and struggle for what was a kind of a new world for them. And yeah, I wonder in the last section of the book how other colonial events in New Zealand might look if we looked a bit deeper at class and at conflict and how those might have kind of played out in other colonizing contexts.
Yes. I mean, I can ask you question after question because I found this quite fascinating, the book. And a couple of things just to finish off. Just for my understanding and the people's understanding as well, what does it mean by piecework? When the company's policies changed and we went into piecework, what would it mean for our listeners?
Sure. So piecework is a payment scheme in a way. In a modern day context, it's kind of the difference between getting an hourly wage or being paid an annual salary. Mm-hmm. So rather than getting a kind of a flat fee for a week's worth of work, piecework meant that the men would be paid for the effort they put in. This had quite an important impact on the struggle because, in one sense, it meant the work could be done in a couple of days. They'd get the same amount that they'd slog out for a week anyway. And then those men who were given land could use the rest of the week to cultivate and to get onto the 5-acre plots that the company had assigned them. Being paid piecework was basically getting paid for the direct amount of work that you were putting in.
So was there... was there discontent for people who might have used the flat fee as a reason to maybe just waste time a little bit? I'm not casting dispersions, but I'm just saying that it becomes more accountable and it becomes more transparent as compared to the flat rate.
Yeah, sure. I mean, the company had complained all along about how little work these men were being, how little work was being done out on the swamps. And interestingly enough, when the piecework scheme comes in and land is offered up by the company, it's interesting to me that not everyone took it up. Quite a few of the gang men were quite happy to just ride the company, getting their kind of weekly, fortnightly pay. They weren't interested in land. And again, that tells me something quite interesting, that yes, there was a strong desire for a lot of these working class immigrants to come out and become landowners, but there was a fragment of those working class immigrants who that wasn't their desire. They were quite happy to ride the company. And then there was a whole segment of workers who simply left Nelson as well. So yeah, it does tell us quite a bit about what some of those working class aspirations were in Nelson in that kind of early colonial time.
So last question. So what happens to the company, the New Zealand company, in the future?
Yeah, and the company essentially goes bankrupt. And you've got the working class immigrants in Nelson pretty much surviving on fern root. There's not much food. Things are scarce. It's pretty dire straits for the men and their families. And the company's gone bankrupt. And that plays quite a significant role in diffusing the revolt as well. There is one moment in late in 1843 or 1844, where a group of the workers storm Nelson town and they're ready to take food and supplies by force if necessary. And they're met on the road by the new police officer who had sent out a message to the store owners to close up shops because these armed men were coming. So, but essentially that was kind of the last gasp of some of those militants that were still hanging out. The bankruptcy of the company changed things completely. And that's another reason why that diffusion of the protest with allocation of land was so important, because it meant a lot of these workers had taken up land and could, you know, scrape by living off the land and through the work of making shift of their wives and the support of Māori as well. But yeah, a lot of people left Nelson. Sue McCliskey is doing her thesis at the moment on the Nelson immigrants and their mobility. She's been a really massive help to this research because she's compiled a whole lot of amazing spreadsheets, and she's looking at that aspect in particular of people just left. So yeah, the bankruptcy did have quite a strong impact on Nelson and also across New Zealand and its other settlement schemes too.
Well, thanks for that. I have more questions, and but I would delve into more research and go into past papers as well. Just for the listeners, it's a fascinating account of a time and place, and it really is quite gripping. So thank you for your work. Now, what's on the table now after this?
Yeah, so the history of a riot, as I mentioned, was an in-between work between finishing Dead Letters and my new book, which is called Blood and Dirt, Prison Labour and the Making of New Zealand. It's forthcoming with Otago University Press. So I've been looking at a different gang of workers, the prison gang, the chain gang, and how they've shaped New Zealand's landscape and infrastructure in the 19th century. So that's hopefully coming out next year, and it's looking at prison labour right from the Hohe Mission Station in 1814 through to the prison farms and the forestry schemes of the early 1900s.
Fantastic. So where can our listeners find you in terms of getting your previous work and getting this book?
Yeah, I have a website. It's jared-davidson.com. Otherwise, I'm on Twitter, an archivist. But the history of a riot, you can visit the Bridget Williams book website, and there's links there for both the ebook and the physical book. And I would just mention this is part of an amazing BWB text series, which I'm just so grateful to be a part of. You know, at $14 or $15, it's such an accessible format for history to be told in. So yeah, I'm really grateful to BWB, and I hope the listeners will support BWB and the larger text series.
Great. Thanks, Jared. Thank you for giving us your time and the in-depth diving in of the co-papa of the book. Hopefully we'll get you back for your new work, and have a fantastic week.
Thank you. Thanks, Ed.